Hello, I'm Michael Rutter. This is number 0524, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0524. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Dr. David Fagenbaum, who is the author of Chasing My Cure. He had a seemingly rare, incurable disease that he worked hard to find a cure for. Not only is it rare for someone to survive once, he relapsed four times.
Extremely rare. Unfortunately, each of these relapses, and each time you get sick with Castleman disease, it's extremely life-threatening. So very few of us, unfortunately, have survived this many relapses. Some patients, if you can get them on the right drug, they can do well. But unfortunately, it's extremely rare to survive this many.
Pete Geiger, the publisher and editor of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac.
I think the almanac, particularly in the last 8 or 10 years, has tried to get people to recycle, to reuse, to repurpose things, and to not create more problems for ourselves. And that's pretty much my position is, you know, we can do things better. We can always have done things better. If we're better to the planet will be better to us. But we're going down a slippery slope right now, and I think with there were fires in the Amazon forest, and there's all kinds of things that are impacting the climate.
Connie West, who owns a motel near Nevada's Area 51. They're expecting perhaps up to 30,000 people later this month looking for aliens. Can their small town handle the influx?
Probably not, but we'll do our best. That's all we can do is try to harness people into it. And please don't take me wrong when I say that, but give them a place to park on private land rather than just nilly-willy through our town. We do not encourage anyone at all to storm the base. That is the dumbest idea anybody could have. Just come, have a party, enjoy yourself, meet new friends, and enjoy the entertainment that'll be here.
There's also an episode of Doug Price on Life as he talks about back to school. Plus, there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0524, was actor Michael Rutter. He's one of the stalwarts of Montreal's acting community, known all across stage and screen and in the studios as a voice in video games and cartoons and narration. He was last seen in Montreal on the Siegel stage, playing the villain in Duty Kravitz, the musical. And he's also an extremely nice guy. Thank you very much, Michael, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 74-year-old Gary Van Ryswick of Sebring, Florida, has been charged with practicing medicine without a license following a bizarre incident at his home. According to the arrest report, Highlands County Sheriff's deputies responded to a 911 hang-up call on August the 18th and were told by Van Ryswick that he had just removed the testicles of a man he'd met on a website for those who have a fetish for castration. Officers found a 53-year-old man from the Tampa area lying on a bed holding a towel to his groin with said body parts in a jar nearby.
It's Operation the Wacky Doctor's Game, where you're the wacky doctor. Batteries not included.
The victim was flown to Tampa for medical treatment. Police also found a surgery room set up in the house with medical equipment and a camera to record the procedures. Investigators said Van Ryswick told them that he had bought painkillers from England and admitted to performing the surgery on at least one other man and on bulls and other animals while living on a farm growing up.
Okay, let's operate.
Operate. Operate.
Where's the dog?
He also said he removed one of his own testicles in 2012. But his most recent procedure went wrong when the patient, and I'm using air quotes here, bled profusely, making it difficult for Van Ryswyk to suture the wounds. For now, he's facing second-degree felony charges and a $250,000 bond. You know, I'm sure every male in the audience listening to this has slowly crossed their legs. And I'm sorry if you're listening to this show while driving. Okay, here is proof once again that people do crazy things in love. 63-year-old Jeffrey Scott Cowett of Elk River, Minnesota, admitted to cops in August that he had purchased 55 pounds of sheetrock screws. That's more than 12,000 screws, folks. And scattered them on local roads to slow down a person he believed was in a relationship with his ex. Specifically, he put them on the road where he believed the man lived and on the roads between that house and the ex-girlfriend's house, among others. The arrest complaint notes that Bear Lake Police had received more than 100 reports of damage from the screws, including to three of their own vehicles. Jeff was charged with first-degree property damage. You know, somewhere in all of this is a metaphor, I'm sure. Perhaps it's, if I'm not getting screwed, everybody else is. After a bus from Northern High School in Durham, North Carolina, dropped off a 17-year-old boy, unknown males were hiding nearby and began to shoot at him. The boy ran and was not injured, but some of the bullets hit his house. Police suspect the bus driver may have arranged a hit on the boy after the driver got into a fight with one of the teen's relatives. According to investigators, a security camera on the bus shows the driver was constantly texting someone throughout the route until the boy got off the bus. A warrant has been filed for the driver's cell phone carrier, seeking copies of the texts the driver was sending. Until then, they don't have enough evidence to charge him in the attempted murder, so the news media is not releasing his name. They did note, however, that he was fired by the school district for texting while driving. Well, driving while texting can also be considered attempted murder. Wow, you know, it's impressive how far we've come with technology. You can even coordinate a hit via your phone. Is there an app for that? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Austrian police say they are hunting for thieves who stole over a dozen bells from cows grazing in the west of the country, said Bernard Gruber, a police spokesman from the Tyrol region. Of course, people may wonder why someone would steal a cowbell.
I got a fever, and the only prescription is more cowbell.
Police are investigating four thefts of a total of 13 cowbells in the Tyrol area in August and say they suspect the thieves in at least three of those cases are the same. Police estimate that the stolen bells were worth a total of less than 1,000 euros. They don't have a high material value, but for the farmers themselves, it's more the sentimental value, Gruber said.
I'm telling you, fellas, you're going to want that cowbell.
Many breeders take their cattle to graze in mountain pastures in the spring, bringing them back down before winter. The festive cattle drive in late September or early October features farmers wearing traditional lederhosen and cows festooned with flowers, and it is a popular tourist draw. Well, let's hope the police solve this heinous crime before the festival. Otherwise, you know what people in the crowd will say.
I'll be honest, fellas, it was sounding great, but I could have used a little more cowbell.
Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Dr. David Fagenbaum is a physician who is probably most living up to the adage of physician, heal thyself. He has personally been dealing with Castleman disease, an extremely rare and deadly condition that acts like a cross between cancer and an autoimmune disease. He's also the author of Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action, which is coming out this month. David joins us on the line from Philadelphia. Hi, David.
Hi, it's an honor to be on the show. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on the program. I guess first off the bat, I have to ask you, how are you right now?
I'm feeling great. It's been 5.5 years since the last time that I was in the hospital for my disease, and I'm feeling really good. Thank you for asking.
Now, not only are you a doctor, but you were a college athlete. You were a quarterback. I've seen pictures of you. So all the way around, you're probably a perfect specimen, both physically and mentally, considering your profession.
No way. And in fact, I think about those early days. Those are my glory days shots, and I look nothing like that these days.
Well, the reason why I bring that up is with all you had going on, both as an athlete and as a medical student, you end up getting what is essentially an extremely rare and deadly disease. Did you go through the why me period of life?
I did. Certainly, I grew up with the belief that, you know, you do the right things, you're good to people, that, you know, good things will happen. You know, why do bad things happen to good people? But earlier on, just before I became ill, my mom actually was diagnosed with a form of cancer and passed away. And that experience of watching her become ill and then pass away, I think it made it so that when I became so ill, after watching the way that she so gracefully dealt with her illness, I think it made me no longer question, you know, why me, because I had seen someone, you know, so special and so wonderful go through so much pain. But I certainly do, and just like anyone, can't help but look back and say, you know, this doesn't feel fair. But I think I've also learned over the years that, unfortunately, many of us that deal with illness and really tough times, it never is fair.
You not only dealt with Castleman disease, which is extremely rare, you also relapsed 4 times. Is that correct?
That's right.
Wow. So, first of all, how rare is Castleman disease?
About 5,000 patients are diagnosed each year in the U.S., so it's about as common as ALS, but certainly much less well-known. And you mentioned that there are multiple relapses. I actually consider that first relapse, or the first time that I almost died, to be the start of my overtime. And I guess that means that I'm in overtime number 5 now. But the important thing about overtime is this concept that every second has to count, and I try to live that way every day.
And in addition to it being rare, how rare is it that someone like yourself can relapse and survive what is essentially 5 times?
Extremely rare. Unfortunately, each of these relapses is, and each time you get sick with Castleman disease, it's extremely life-threatening. So very few of us, unfortunately, have survived this many relapses. It's important to some patients, if you can get them on the right drug, they can do well. But unfortunately, it's extremely rare to survive this many.
Was this something, let's look at the chronology here, was this something that happened to you earlier in life? Like, how old were you? And basically, I'm asking the question because did you become a doctor because of your illness, or was medicine something you were headed toward and this happened to you?
So I was a third-year medical student when I became ill. I was totally healthy, treating patients, training to become a cancer doctor. I wanted to treat patients in memory of my mom. When I myself became a patient in the hospital, I spent months hospitalized, most of the time in the ICU. I had a retinal hemorrhage, went blind in my left eye. I gained 50 pounds of fluid. I was so sick, I had my last rites read to me back in November of 2010. But fortunately, I was eventually diagnosed and received chemotherapy that was able to save my life. Unfortunately, I went on to, as you said, relapse after relapse after relapse. And in the midst of that, as a medical student, I decided that I would dedicate the rest of my life, however long that may be, to trying to treat and cure my disease. And so I spent the rest of my time in medical school studying Castleman disease patient samples in the lab. Most of those samples were my own, and trying to understand this disease. That was a real mystery, and for 60 years, no one has known how it works.
From a studying point of view, I mean, obviously this is something that's very near and dear to your heart because you are dealing with this personally. From a scientific point of view, were there any hurdles you had to go through, or was there any kind of problematic issue because you were someone who was so close to the disease you were studying?
Oh, absolutely. You know, any time you perform research or you're involved in science and you have some sort of potential bias, and in this case, you know, I have the disease that gives me a bias, you have to be really careful. And so for me, that's meant that I've always involved many other people in reviewing the data that's generated in the lab, looking through what we learn and trying to look at it from different angles to make sure that I'm not interpreting it in a way because, as you said, because I may be too close to it.
You've written the book, Chasing My Cure. As you mentioned earlier, you're 5 years in remission.
That's right, and it's 5 years since I identified a drug in the lab that I thought could actually help me. It's a drug that's been around for over 25 years. It was developed for kidney transplantation, and no one had ever tried it before for Castleman disease. But based on the research I did in my lab on my samples, I thought this drug might actually be able to help me, and so I started on it. As I said, 5.5 years ago, and it's I've been in remission. We actually have just started a clinical trial just last week here at the University of Pennsylvania to give this drug to 24 more patients, and hopefully it's going to be helpful for many other patients as well.
Do you have to do anything physically or with medication to maintain your health because of what you went through?
I do. I continue to take this medication every day. I also get an infusion once a month of another medication, and I basically, other than that, I'm able to go back to a full life. I run a research lab here at the University of Pennsylvania. I run a research foundation called the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, and I also, just a year ago, my wife and I had our first child, Amelia, so I also get to be Amelia's dad and go through all the ups and downs and the journey of having a one-year-old.
Excellent, excellent. Now, is Castleman disease hereditary? Where does it come from, being it's so rare?
So we don't know that. My form of Castleman's is called idiopathic multicentric, and that's because idiopathic, meaning we don't know what causes it. Basically, your immune system becomes hyperactivated and then starts to attack all of your vital organs for an unknown cause. And so up until now, we've generally treated these patients with chemotherapy to try to kill the immune system. But this drug I'm on is not a chemotherapy. It's an immunosuppressant to suppress the immune system, and it seems to be working for me. But I think this begs a really important question that's even bigger than Castleman disease, and that's that this drug was developed for kidney transplantation, but it's saving my life. There are 1,500 drugs already FDA approved for at least one condition, and there are 7,000 diseases that don't have any drugs approved for them. How many of those 1,500 drugs that are already approved for something might actually be treatments or cures for the 7,000 diseases that don't have any?
Now that you're a father, and as you say, we don't know where this disease comes from, does that concern you, the fact that you are now a father?
It does. You know, certainly we think that there's probably a genetic component to this disease. We don't yet know the role that genetics play in Castleman disease. I run a lab where we work on that day in and day out. So we're doing all the work we need to understand how this disease works and you know, how it progresses. But fortunately, most patients with Castleman disease, over 95% of patients, do not have children or family members with the disease. It typically does not run in families. There's rare cases where it does, but it typically does not.
When you were dealing with this personally, how quickly did it progress?
Very quickly. I went from being a healthy third-year medical student treating patients with no medical issues to being to literally dying in the intensive care unit within just a couple weeks. I spent months hospitalized, and as I mentioned before, incredibly ill. So this disease can hit rapidly, and you get very sick very quickly. Unfortunately, it's tough to diagnose, and so we spend a lot of time trying to make sure that patients will get diagnosed more quickly.
Was this something that was, and I guess it's hard to quantify, but was this something that was possibly harder for you to deal with, or was more scary because you actually had a medical knowledge? You know, sometimes a little bit of knowledge is a frightening thing for people.
I think so. When I was at first in the hospital and I would hear about what my blood tests were and what the results were, it was frightening because I knew just how bad they were. They were tests that maybe I had never even seen before in my dying patients. I hadn't even seen levels that badly. I guess maybe fortunately I got so sick that I really lost the ability to think clearly, and so that meant that my brain could no longer focus on that kind of stuff because I was so sick that I really was unconscious, and in some ways maybe that was actually a good thing. But there also were times when I was kind of floating in and out of consciousness where I could actually reflect back on my life and think about my life and maybe regrets that I had, things that I looked on fondly. And it was those sort of moments, the coming close to death, that I learned a lot about life. I learned that I didn't regret anything that I did do in my life. I didn't regret anything that I said or I did. What I regretted were things that I didn't say or I didn't do or that I wouldn't be able to do in my future. And those sort of lessons about life, things that I said, if I can just get out of the ICU, if I can survive this, I'm going to do this differently when I live. And those sort of lessons, things that I learned along the way, are what I really try to get across in the book, because I wish I didn't need to have my last rites read to me in order to learn these lessons. I wish that I could have learned them from reading a book, but I did have my last rites read to me, and I did learn these lessons, and so I really want to share these lessons with the world. I want to try to create a silver lining out of this really difficult experience for me that could actually be helpful for others.
The book is called Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. Written by Dr. David Fagenbaum. David, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us, and I'm very glad that you're healthy and you have a family and everything is working out fine for you.
It was an honor to be on, and I so appreciate your time. Thank you.
Dr. David Fagenbaum, author of Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0524, and you'll find links to David's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the publisher and editor of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac. Plus, we'll meet a motel owner who is near Area 51 in Nevada. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Let's get back to the stuff. Okay, here's another type of story that has become all too regular, so perhaps this is a good time to offer up a primer to those who want to pretend to be police officers. First, get yourself a real siren and not just an air horn. Second, get more lights than just your car's four-way flashers. Third, and this is probably most important, choose wisely as to who you're going to pull over. There was almost a new sheriff in town in Long Island. A Long Island man impersonating a police officer tried to take the law into his own hands when he pulled over a van and found it full of real detectives. According to Nassau County Police, 25-year-old Valerie Portlock was driving his black Nissan Sentra at about 11 a.m. when he drove up behind a van and activated his air horn and emergency lights. When the van stopped in traffic, the detectives from the Nassau PD's electronic squad got out, identified themselves, and tried to approach Portlock's car. That's when the faux cop fled the scene, swerving into oncoming traffic and speeding onto the Long Island Expressway. Nassau County Highway Patrol spotted him shortly after and pulled him over to make the arrest. Portlock was charged with criminal impersonation in the first degree, as well as reckless endangerment and unlawful fleeing from a police officer. Poor Portlock. You know, he's going to be laughed at during arraignment, during trial, during sentencing by all levels of law enforcement. Then he's going to be laughed at by fellow inmates in jail. I feel for him. Oh, I still will laugh at him, but I do feel for him. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Florida man apparently didn't appreciate being told to flush the toilet in another person's home after using it. He allegedly threatened the fellow who complained by threatening to chop him with a machete. The suspect, 46-year-old Keith Mounts, later offered this all-too-appropriate explanation to police. Blank happened. As a result of the crappy situation, Pasco County Sheriff's deputies arrested Mounts on a felony aggravated assault charge. The alleged incident occurred at the unnamed victim's home in Hudson, located about 30 miles north of Tampa, and Newsweek got the straight poop from the sheriff's office spokesperson. The suspect didn't flush, and when the victim called him on it, the suspect threatened him with a machete, the spokesperson said. The victim called 911, and when police arrived on the scene, they found a machete in the yard that reportedly belonged to Mounts. Although Mounts told police he was using the weapon to defend himself, officers said he could not give a reason as to why he needed to do that in the first place. Mounts later gave a written statement to investigators that summed up things simply and succinctly. Excrement happened. And trust me, excrement wasn't the synonym he used. Well, you know he isn't a water conservationist because then he'd know the old adage, if it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. Yeah. Speaking of which, that reminds me of the days when I did open line radio and you had some belligerent blowhard of a caller who just wouldn't shut up. I'd make sure that the last thing they heard on the air was this little jingle.
Uh-oh.
You're getting flushed. So sorry.
Yeah. It was either that jingle or this one.
Thank you for your uninformed opinion.
Ah, the good old days. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We are near the end of the summer. That means the latest edition of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac is here. The 2020 version has just dropped, continuing a tradition that started with the first publication back in 1818. On the line with us, as he is every year, is Pete Geiger, the publisher and editor of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac. He joins us on the line from Maine. Hi, Peter.
Hey, nice to be with you.
Nice to
as
have
always, every year it's nice to be with you.
Yeah, nice
to
have
you. We're both still here.
Exactly. Nice to have you on the program once again. Each year we talk about the events that are taking place and the collection of information that is contained in each of the editions of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac. This year, I want to ask you a slightly different question, because one of the things that people always talk about, of course, is the weather. And that's always a big interest when people are getting the Canadian Farmer's Almanac. But nowadays, of course, we are more concerned about a longer picture thing, and that is climate change. Is that something that is in the forefront of your mind as well and of those who work on the Canadian Farmer's Almanac?
Well, I think it's in the forefront. I mean, there has been climate change forever, and there have been huge cycles of really hot years and very cold years. So I'm not a scientist, so to some extent global warming has become a political thing, but I think that the Almanac, particularly in the last 8 or 10 years, has tried to get people to recycle, to reuse, to repurpose things, and to not create more problems for ourselves. And that's pretty much my position is, you know, we can do things better. We can always have done things better. And if we're better to the planet will be better to us. But we're going down a slippery slope right now. And I think with there were fires in the Amazon forest, and there's all kinds of things that are impacting the climate. When it comes to doing my weather, I can't take climate change into consideration because climate is changing, but I can't. It's not a thing I can look at and measure. So I think long term, I do have some concerns. But I would also say that if you go back, the 70s were very cold, very heavy snows, a lot of storms. If you go back into the 30s, it was hot and dry and there was a dust bowl. So you sometimes got to step back and look at the bigger picture. And I would say that we better as people do a better job of not polluting, not wasting, and for all the right reasons, and part of it is the climate.
Well, let's talk about this current edition, the 2020 edition. I like to call it the hindsight edition.
Yes.
Some of the things right on the cover that I want to talk, you 16 plant-based substitutes. That's another issue that's making the news these days. So what are some of the plant-based substitutes that you like to talk about in this issue of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac?
Well, I think that was relative to diets and eating a healthier diet. And so there's, you know, instead of eating meat, you eat tempeh, which is a soy-based product. Instead of using tofu, sometimes which are essentially beans, you can have butter substitutes. So if you have a recipe that calls for butter, you can use applesauce, avocado, things like that. And a cheese substitute is cashew and potato provolone, and so forth. So my brother in particular, and for my company in Lewiston, we've been really pushing eating healthier, and a lot of it is plant-based. But I don't know that I will ever get to the point where I only eat plants. But there are plant substitutes which make for a healthier diet. And so we have, I know it's a 4 or 5 page story that talks about all the different substitutes. You know, dairy substitutes, instead of milk, you can use almond milk, which is actually quite good, soy milk, hemp milk, things like that. So there are ways to substitute things that aren't as healthy for you with things that are healthier. And I don't think anybody would argue that a plant-based diet is actually a good thing. The question is, can you get yourself to that point?
Well, you also, in this edition, have 10 bugs to eat and how to cook them.
Yes, I really like that one, because sometimes you see these shows on TV where you're stranded in the boondocks and you got to decide how to live. And so whether it is termites, although not termites from your house, but termites from rotten trees, or grasshoppers, you can eat almost any kind of bug. Like, what you can eat are bugs that have kind of a red stripe on them. I'm trying to find the exact age, but yeah, you can't have, if it has a red stripe or I think a brown stripe, you don't want to eat those bugs. But you can eat all kinds of bugs. And so we have I'll say it was the recipes, but we list 10 bugs that are actually quite good to eat, healthy to eat.
And by the way, for those following along at home in the program, it's page 32.
Thank you. Okay, there you go.
You know, living in an urban center, I've often wondered, quite whimsically, why we haven't found a way to eat the pigeon. I mean, that would solve two problems, I think.
I'm going to start with, when I can start eating bugs, then I'll start thinking about those, the pigeons. But, yeah, I mean, you know, there are 10 different bugs that you can eat, and you can roast them. And the crickets, you got to remove the legs. You got to dry roast them, or you can stir fry them. And grasshoppers, you got to remove the legs. You can skewer them. You can roast them over coals. You can brush them with teriyaki sauce. It just sounds delightful. So, yes, those are one of the things we're featuring this year in the almanac.
Do you have another?
You know, we have another section on weather-dependent professions. You know, we sometimes forget how many professions are dependent upon what the weather's going to be. And so whether you're an astronaut, a ski instructor, a beekeeper, archaeologist, a farmer, a pilot, all of these professions are dependent upon the weather. And it's not just mild winters, but it's snowy winters, and it's, you know, it's all kinds of weather.
Mm. Now, another item you have, and this would be on page 10, newer and clever ways for balloon to use balloons, sleds, and wine corks.
Yes, so that's under our helpful hints section. In terms of balloons, you can have fun with balloons, and if you blow it up, put it into, use frozen water, blow it up, and you freeze it, then it becomes, it can keep your beverages cold, and then once it melts, then you can use them as a water balloon fight. If you're going camping, you can use a plastic snow sled with a rope that you can haul your camp gear around. And if you have moles in your ground, you can crush several cloves of garlic and stick the mesh into the mole tunnels. They hate the smell. And the corks are kind of interesting. I actually, when I was, used to have a junior achievement company, we used to take wine corks and we used to glue them onto a back and make it a board for pinning notes on. But you can use cork as planters. So what you do is you take the cork, put it on a stick or skewer, and mark what's on, you know, what is being planted in each of the rows, and that tells you what's there. So you can use your corkscrews for that reason.
You know, one of the things that's always fascinating about the Farmer's Almanac each and every year is that it comes up with little tips and clever ways of using things that are literally around your house all the time. Every time I see these, it's always an aha moment. Never thought of doing that, but wow, what a brilliant idea. How do you collect these in the first place?
Well, I think, you know, people are always sending us ideas and things, and we're always looking for them. I think one of the more interesting ones this year is a bathroom brainstorm. And if you hang a second shower curtain either on the inside or the outside of your shower, you can use the second rod to hang your towels or clothes that you need to be line dried. So, and then if you have a six-pack, instead of throwing away the cardboard six-pack carrier, use it to store guns, glue, pencils, other kind of tools.
Oh.
I mean, we really can be very efficient if we think about it. If we really want to be, we can actually do a good job. And I know Canada is a potato country, much as the state of Maine is all about potatoes. And we have a whole bunch of useful hints for potatoes. It does everything from poison ivy treatment. If you whip a raw potato into a paste and put it on your poison ivy and leave it for 15 minutes and rinse it off, it helps. It's an ID puffer. You can slices of raw potatoes will help reduce the swelling, puffing on your eyes. So lay slices on your eyes, relax for 10 minutes, and it's depuffed. It's a splinter remover. So if you have a splinter, you cut a thin slice of potato, and you put that on your finger for 10 to 20 minutes. And if you want to do it overnight, you can just tape it to your finger, and then in the morning you can just pull the splinter out. It removes rust. It's a soup rescuer. It's like this wonder, I won't say a wonder drug, it's a wonder vegetable.
Well, again, this just proves what I've always said, that there is so much information chock full into each and every edition of the almanac that I can't imagine someone not having an issue of the almanac. You know, I have, thanks to you, because not only here, but on the old radio show, I've had an opportunity to go through the almanacs year after year after year. And it's one of the things that I don't get rid of. I have them all from the years we've been talking.
And that's the reason that sometimes somebody will say to me that my grandparents have died and I have like 50 almanacs, because you don't get rid of them. They're actually reference books as much as they're anything, and people will save the recipes, save whatever. But speaking of recipes, this year we Kiwa was our recipe contest, and we had three winners. This next year it's going to be bananas. So if anybody's particularly adept at cooking something interesting with bananas, there is a contest and valuable prizes.
Excellent. People can find out more information by going to the website farmersalmanac.com, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct, yes, absolutely. And I think you can even download it. I don't know if you can do the Canadian edition or just the American, but you can actually download an entire edition. It is just a resource. And I really think the millennials, the next generation, is the generation that's going to be worried about the environment and worried about polluting and lack of materials. And so I really think the millennials, while they may not run out to buy an almanac in a store, although they may, certainly do go online. In fact, my most popular page is Moon Phases, and that's women about 30 to 38. And the second most popular page is actually fishing and hunting, and that's males 20 to 27 or 28. So the nice thing about the internet is you can tell who's coming and what they're interested in. A little bit more difficult with the almanac itself.
Always fascinating to have you on the program to talk about the latest edition of the Farmer's Almanac, and thanks for being on the program with us once again.
My pleasure.
Pete Geiger, the publisher and editor of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac. You can check out their website at farmersalmanac.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0524, and you'll find links to their site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And, as I mentioned earlier, since it's back to school, I thought we'd have a feature with Doug Price. Here is his thoughts on returning to the classroom with Doug Price on life.
Very fond memories of back to school. Well, first of all, because I no longer have to go back to school. And second, because I somehow survived. Don't remember much about kindergarten, sort of like today's daycare, but without the metal detectors. Elementary school, on the other hand, was quite confusing for me, because you really didn't have a home room, per se, but I did feel right at home in the principal's office day after day. One particular incident does come to mind when I was appointed captain of the school's crossing guards. Until I made a mad dash across the street without looking both ways, and my captain's cap was immediately taken away, which might explain why later in life I never ever held a management position. So, I was a full-blown rebel without a cause, delinquent works, when my parents took me out of public school and sentenced me to 3 years of British boot camp private school. Nice uniform, though, short pants, where I earned my colors for soccer excellence, plus my black and blue stripes from the constant caning. Price, assume your customary position. The following year, yes, I headed to high school, and I could feel that rebel yell of adrenaline pulsating through my veins, and I began to entertain the idea of becoming some sort of performer. In fact, at the fall fair, I donned a ballerina tutu, while being sure to apply black shoe polish under my armpits to mask the hair that wasn't quite there yet. Okay, so I was a shy guy as well, with feelings. And then seemingly suddenly, I was catapulted into first-year university with a major in theater. Until our very dramatic professor of the dramatic arts announced in no uncertain terms on our first day of enlightenment that as of the next morning, everyone must show up wearing black leotards for our dance movement instruction. Huh? I'm out of here. In hindsight, I was so miffed about the leotards that I completely forgot my acting eagerness of slipping into that ballerina outfit the year before. Remember the black shoe polish? In fact, if I recall correctly, I think a pair of very sheer nylons were involved too. But no matter, because I did graduate. Hypocrite first class. My parents were so proud.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File program coming to you from Montreal, Canada, a country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the owner of a motel near Area 51 in Nevada. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, but I got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And speaking of Nevada, in that state, a DUI defense lawyer was arrested on suspicion of, wait for it, DUI, after a crash in the southeast Las Vegas Valley. And get this, it's the third time he has faced that charge, according to the Nevada Highway Patrol. 54-year-old Garrett Ogata was arrested on suspicion of second-degree DUI, failure to use due care, and driving without a valid driver's license, all misdemeanors. According to Ogata's website, he focuses his practice in DUI defense and criminal defense. Officers were called at about 2:30 a.m. Friday to a crash involving an Aston Martin and a Toyota SUV. The two occupants in the Toyota were hospitalized with non-life-threatening injuries. Ogata was driving the Aston Martin. He had 5 prior traffic-related court cases in Clark County dating to 1999. In fact, in one of his recent cases, Ogata served 2 days in jail in a 2016 case, and in January, he was sentenced to DUI school, which he completed in February. Ogata's website lists him as a member of the National College for DUI Defense and an instructor for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. As his website states, our goal as Las Vegas DUI attorneys is to get all charges dismissed, an acquittal at trial, or charges reduced to a non-DUI level. Okay, is this the clown you want for your lawyer when you're facing DUI charges? Actually, I take that back. Maybe you would. Your judgment is already impaired at this point anyway. Well, let's get to our last guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Connie West, co-owner of an alien-themed motel in the tiny U.S. desert outpost of Rachel, Nevada, believes they are coming no matter what. Not aliens, but alien hunters. A whimsical invitation on Facebook has urged UFO enthusiasts to gather on September 20th and storm nearby Area 51, a U.S. military base long rumored to house extraterrestrials and spaceships. More than 2 million Facebook users have said they plan to go. Connie is the owner of the motel Little Ailey Inn. She joins us on the line from Rachel, Nevada. Hi, Connie.
Hi. How are you doing?
Thanks very much for being on the program with us. As the story says, more than 2 million people have said they're going to go. Now, no one expects that, but you think that at least 30,000 might show up.
The numbers we've collected are anywhere from 5 to 30,000.
Can the town of Rachel handle this?
Probably not. But we'll do our best. That's all we can do is try to harness people into it. And please don't take me wrong when I say that, but give them a place to park on private land rather than just nilly-willy through our town. We do not encourage anyone at all to storm the base. That is the dumbest-ass idea anybody could have. Just come, have a party, enjoy yourself, meet new friends, and enjoy the entertainment that'll be here.
Well, speaking of the entertainment, I guess it's the old saying, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. Since you've got these people showing up, you guys have actually planned a sort of musical event, a sort of concert. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we have. We have a lot of entertainment coming. Can't announce that yet. We have vendors that'll be here that want to come, food trucks to assist us in providing nutrition for everyone. It ought to be fun. There's going to be a genre of music. When this first started, a band reached out to me and said they would like to come and play. We advised them that we don't encourage anybody to do that, and this is not Armagosa Valley. They didn't want to be part of it. I would have to say about 93% of the people I've spoke to don't want to have anything to do with storming the base. They just want to come out and have a party and be in Rachel.
Now, you have embraced this idea of these people coming to town, but not everyone in your community has done that. Some people even want the road closed that leads into town to keep people away during that time. What is the breakdown, if any, between those who are keen on the idea and those who are against it? And is this bringing any kind of a rift amongst those in the community?
You know, as far as that goes, my comment on that is everybody has the right to their own opinion and everybody has the right to their own fears. I have the same fears, you know, that things are going to get out of control. I only tried to make something negative into a positive and harness people away from my neighbors. You know, originally our phone was ringing. People said they were coming. As a business owner, of course, I had to embrace it. I didn't know it was ever going to be anything like this. To this extent and this many people.
Well, tell us about the Little Alien. I mean, your establishment, how little or how big is it? How many people can you actually accommodate?
My occupancy is 43 people. That includes my employees. We're just a tiny little place in a tiny little town. We've been world famous for decades. You know, we do our best to give everyone a unique experience with our hair. We have amazing food, great conversation.
Generally speaking, what kinds of people have stayed at your inn through the years? Those who enjoy the folklore of the area, or do you get some people who are, quite frankly, really serious about the whole thing?
We get them all, every way, every walk of life, every opinion. and to each their own opinion. We are not ones to tell people how they're supposed to think. My dad used to say this was an open information center and an exchange of ideas. So yeah, we've had every type of people, just people that want to come out and, you know, check out the scenery or the skies. We have amazing skies. Of course, we get the hardcore, you know, true believers, and then we just get the curious. It attracted all kinds throughout the years.
And what about those of you who actually live in the community, like yourself, for instance? Where do you fall in the curious to true believer category of the people who live in Rachel and Area 51?
I can't answer for the people in Rachel. I can only answer for myself. And I truly believe if you look up and you look out, you know, it's so vast out there. I hope there's something else out there besides us.
Without this event taking place, normally speaking, what are the busiest times of the year for you? Or is it a place that you are hopefully busy year-round?
Well, the last few years, we've been busy year-round. Our busiest season, of course, is the spring and summer. And we get people from all over the world here. So when other countries are on holiday, we happen to be a thoroughfare between the national parks, Yosemite and Zion. We always have a flow of traffic coming down here. Are we busier now than ever? Absolutely.
And what are the kinds of things, let's be delicate about this. You said there's a lot of food trucks coming. There's maybe 5,000 to 30,000 people showing up. Simple things like, oh, I don't know, porta potties. Do you have enough of them in the area to handle what's the influx of what's coming in, or is this going to be like another mini Woodstock?
Well, I'm hoping we have enough. Originally, when this all came about, within 4 or 5 days of this blowing wide open in July, I ordered 30 porta-johns for the campers that would be here. However, we've increased that dramatically, and we've had to reach outside of our county for assistance in that, being as how there are 3 major events going on in Vegas the same weekend, and one that will be getting out on the other side of the state. So we're doing our best, but resources are stretched thin in our state right now because of all the major events that are happening.
And you mentioned the limited...
We will have a lot of porta-johns.
Yeah, you mentioned you have a limited amount of space when it comes to what your little alien can accept. But you also mentioned parking, and you said campers. So is there a large area that you can accommodate people who are going to be camping out in their campers? And how many can you accommodate there?
Thankfully, I have some really sweet neighbors. When this all blew up, we sat out here and went, oh, Lord, how are we going to do this? Because I have 30 acres out back, and I thought I could put the campers there. And my neighbors came up and said, hey, I've got this 5 acres or this 10, utilize it for parking and camping. And so in all, we have about 75 acres of parking for camping or space for camping.
This sounds like a great entrepreneurial idea, and it sounds like you're going to have a lot of fun. I know you guys don't need to be put on the map because you're already on the map, but if this turns out to be a big event, the worldwide press you could get from this could be exponential, and it could be a fantastic boon. Do you think there's a possibility that if this goes well and 30,000 people show up, that what was initially a Facebook post could actually turn into perhaps an annual event?
It's a possibility, yes. As far as the press goes, we've already had so much coverage, it's kind of ludicrous that people are covering this the way they are. Exciting, and it's terrifying all at the same time. And I'm hoping that everything goes the way, you know, it's going to happen no matter what.
Well, exciting and
I didn't ask for it. People just said that they were coming, and we tried to accommodate the best we could. And then the intern, you know, we're trying to turn something negative into a positive and provide people with a great event.
Well, exciting and terrifying is the way some people might actually describe Area 51. Good luck with the event coming up on the weekend of September the 20th, and thank you very much, Connie, for taking the time to talk with us.
Absolutely. If anybody has any questions about camping, they can go to alienstockparking.com and get all your questions answered.
Great. Thank you very much, Connie.
Thank you. Have an amazing day.
Connie West, co-owner of Little Ailey Inn in Rachel, Nevada. It's the place to be on the weekend of September the 20th. As Connie mentioned, you can find out more info by going to alienstockparking.com, and you can also find out more about her motel by going to her website. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0524, and you'll find all of those links. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Bell County, Texas, Precinct 3, Constable Thomas Prado is tasked with arresting fugitives. As part of that job, he often puts wanted posters on his Facebook page. One recent post urged DeAndre Green, who was wanted on a probation violation, to, quote, call my office. We will be glad to give you a free Uber ride to your local Bell County bed and breakfast, unquote. And by the way, that would be the jail. Some fugitives, Prado says, do call and turn themselves in, but Green said Prado would never catch him. I'm on an island sipping mojitos, he taunted in a comment on Prado's post. I'll call when I make it back to town. Kisses, kisses, kisses. After several more such comments, Prado tracked Green down, 5 hours away in Midland, Texas. He drove there, got backup from the Midland County Sheriff's Office, and confronted Green at a store. When Green spotted him, his eyes went wide with shock, and this time it wasn't an emoji, a reporter said. Time from the post to arrest? 2 days. Prado says he has no ill feelings about Green, and when he's released, he'll have mojitos with him. Now, why? Oh, why? When you see your own wanted picture up on a police officer's Facebook page, would you post comments on said page taunting the officer in daring him to capture you? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0524. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0524. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple and Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.